is the RCR, the Retro Computing Roundtable, recorded Saturday, November 5th, show 18. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I'd like to know. Will I ever find my way back to Oz? We're the guys who talk about computer history nostalgia like there's nothing wrong with it. I'm your host of this show, and I'm David in the greater Atlanta, Georgia area. I also read the Stan Veit's History of the Personal Computer audiobook podcast, and I sometimes even do a classic computing video podcast someday soon. We also have Carrington Vanson, and he's in Toronto, Canada. He's the host of 1 Megahertz, the Apple II podcast, and co-host of the Double Take podcast.
Hello.
Carrington, doing okay today?
I'm doing awesome.
Right and happy?
Yes.
Good.
I just put my motorcycle in storage, so I'm unhappy about that, but everything else is great.
Oh, for the winter?
Mm-hmm. Winter comes to Canada.
Yeah. And we also have Earl Evans, our other regular. He's in Portland, Oregon, and he's host of the Retro Bits podcast and the original Computer History Podfather. Hey.
I'm doing good. I've had my iced venti triple espresso with white mocha flavor, so I am amped up and ready for the show.
Dang it, all I had was a regular coffee.
I'm naturally caffeinated.
Yeah, we've learned that. So before we get started, let's find out what's new with our hosts. So, Carrington, how about you?
Very little, just lack of motorcycling. It disappoints me. I got a new bike at the end of the season, which is a terrible time to buy one because you get it, you ride it for like 2 weeks, and then you put it away. Alas.
And you mean the end of like the good
weather? The riding season. End of the season without snow in Canada. That really brief window of opportunity, that great weekend where it doesn't snow.
Has that been your regular transportation?
No, I have a car as well for like to and from work stuff, but I'm very much a two-wheel guy, like scooters and motorcycles and that kind of stuff. So.
And what is it? What's the motorcycle?
This is a Harley. It's a Street Bob. So
I got
a 2012 Street Bob. So yeah, I'm really enjoying
it. Yeah.
I dig it. Cool. I mean, I like the little ones as well. I like the, you know, my little scooter and stuff. I love my Vespa, but sometimes you want the big hog. So.
And I know before the show you were telling me and Earl about your website difficulties. So you're
holy cow, domain difficulties. Yeah, I lost Monster Feet for a while. I do not like my domain name registrar for that. It's the only domain name I have on that registrar. I won't name and shame them. Maybe next episode if I'm still having problems. But nightmare, like just a night, like a 6 week nightmare trying to now get it all back. I think it's all now set again and I can get back into podcasting and stuff, but it's been a crazy, crazy behind the scenes nightmare. Ugh, don't like it.
We're missing the sound of tearing envelopes and
tell me about it. Yeah, luckily the Double Take stuff has been up, but that's been sporadic. It's had to like miss 2 weeks because of difficulties and stuff, but yeah.
Okay. And Earl, what's up with you?
Well, life is good. And, you know, things are busy, hectic as always. But the thing that's obsessed me over the last couple of weeks here is I got a mini computer. I got two. It's a DEC PDP 1123 system.
Cool. And it's overjoyed.
Yeah. Well, it's in the garage. This is a garage computer, not a house computer. It stands, you know, about the size of a small refrigerator, and it's got the main CPU card cage unit and a couple of 10 megabyte removable hard drive systems where the hard drive is in this big, you know, bigger than a Frisbee and about an inch to an inch and a half thick removable 10 megabyte cartridge that, you know, comes out of the unit. And anyway, the thing's awesome.
Dude, where did you get yourself this big iron?
So there was an ad in Craigslist. Someone locally was giving this away and was saying, if you don't come get it by the end of the month, it's going to the recycler, which, you know, retro computing fans would be, no, don't do that. And that made it to the Vintage Computer Forums, which I saw, and I was Johnny on the spot. And so he had it. It took a lot to get it to my house. I mean, multiple trips with my SUV to haul this thing. We had to de-rack all the equipment, get it here, put it all back together. I did all the testing and everything like that. But anyway, to make a long story longer, it's up and running, and there's enough spare parts to build a second one. And I, in fact, did that. I built a second one, just the card cage and the CPU and the RAM unit. I've been doing so much playing around with this that it just makes my head spin.
Dude, but you have to get some sort of cart on wheels and start using this in the Starbucks. You would be the ultimate hipster.
Yeah, bring my mini computer. I actually took the chassis with me, not the drives and, you know, the rack mount and all that stuff, but I took just a mini computer with me to the Commodore Club meeting last night. I was like, all right, everybody, you know, move your 64s out of the way. I got a mini computer. And I brought it with a, you know, actually part of the haul that I got was a DEC VT100 terminal, which is, you know, the quintessential terminal of ye old. I got two of those, actually. And yeah, it's funny because also part of the haul was an S100 chassis that's just the chassis and the card slots, but another S100 system that's pretty rare. It's called a Alpha Micro AM100.
I've heard of that.
And yeah, it's it's hard to find too much information about it online, except for people to say this is very rare. So
cool.
I don't know. I may have accidentally stumbled onto something fairly valuable here with
very
this.
Nice. I had an S100, but not anything particularly rare. I've never even heard of that one.
Well, this one, the chip in it is an LSI 11 chip, very similar to the DEC mini computers, and it was a very powerful S100 system in the days, you know, that it was introduced. So I'm looking forward to seeing what I can do with that. And it doesn't have a disk drive, doesn't have the operating system, but it's possible that with the wonders of the internet, I might be able to get it up and running. But that's what's going on with me.
Do you guys, if you look in the show notes, do you see where I put that link in? Underneath
yes.
your name right there. Oh, just click on that real quick. It's just Google Images, which this could change by the time people get to the show notes. Mm-hmm. But what is your – did we put a link in the last show to an 1123? I thought maybe I put a generic one or something. But what does it look like? Does it look like one of these like white cabinets?
So if you're seeing the same set of links that I'm –
should be, yeah.
The one on COSAM.org, COSAM.org.
Kind of where we're on the page here.
It's tall and, you know, standing on some casters, and it has a little thing kind of second from the top that says DEC Data System.
Okay. I'm trying to find it.
Well, if you go to the images on the link.
Oh, okay. The second one there says front.jpg. Right.
Exactly. Front.
Yeah. Okay. So that's what it looks like.
It looks almost exactly like that, except instead of saying 1123 plus, it just says 1123 because that's what it is.
So currently it's the second one from the left at the top in the Google search here, which it probably – this won't change too much by the time anyone checks it out. But then if you look all the way to the right, four down, that's a VT100 right there.
Yes.
A terminal. Yeah, that's a classic. That one and the Lear Siegler are kind of the two classic, I think, are – I know Lear – there's another brand that looks like a Lear Siegler.
Are you going to wear a lab coat when you use it?
Yeah. You see the people?
Well, it's a requirement in 11 states that you do that.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's a misdemeanor in three.
But I did also get a metric ton of extra cards and components for
you
this thing.
You Americans
like I said,
don't know what a metric ton is.
I had to learn for the purposes of this computer.
Okay.
And also 40 of the hard drive packs, the little, you know, 10 megabyte disk packs for this. If you look at that front.jpg image, you'll see the things on the top and on the bottom that say RL02. Those are 10 megabyte hard drives, and they're actually removable hard drive cartridges that you pull out of there. It's a lot of fun. When it spins up, it sounds like a washing machine.
And the lights dim.
Thank you for letting me go first when we talked about what we've been up to.
Well, and I put a link to just a Wikipedia about Alpha Microsystems there, which was started by French. I just went blank here. Went back to it. Yeah, John French, who was in the Homebrew Computer Club. So it was founded by John French, Dick Wilcox, and Bob Hitchcock. I think John French was in the – I'm pretty certain he was in the Homebrew Computer Club. I think it started in his garage. Now I got to look that up, right? All right. Do you guys know that?
Nope.
No, didn't know that.
Or not? Let's see. All right. Let's see if the source of all
stuff
knowledge.
Up again?
Blah, 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 blah. Oh, it's okay. And which met? Okay, da da da. Yep. Oh, Gordon French. I'm wrong.
Oh, his brother.
You think so?
I'm just making it up.
Again, you Americans, you don't know French.
Yeah. So it was started by Gordon French and Fred Moore. Okay, so the last name was the same. Well, anyway, moving along. Then we're going to try to keep the show to a a regular length. So about me,
for
some reason I've gotten sick. I don't know if that's coming through on the show, but I've been sneezing like crazy all morning. Here in my house, I feel better, so I haven't been sneezing or my nose hasn't been running. So it's got to be something outdoors. And so what happened is Georgia's largest ham festival, so they say, happened today in Lawrenceville, which is in the greater Atlanta area. So I went there with another member of the Atlanta Historical Computing Society. And so that was fun. I bought one thing, not that old, but I got a Hewlett-Packard palm top. It's a 660LX. So I guess I'll try to find a link for that and put it in the show notes. But it's an early Windows CE device.
Oh, cool.
You know, which is has its place in the development of the, you know, palm top computing and stuff. So that's kind of cool. Otherwise, it was you know, a lot of radios and stuff. A lot of consumer, really old tube radios too, which I wish I had the money and some space. There's a beautiful Grundig that was there. I don't know if you guys are familiar with those, but just this big sort of an early entertainment center.
Sure.
You know, I've seen pictures. I've never had one. I have a current Grundig shortwave.
Oh, do you really?
Yeah, and I love it. But
yeah, just really well made, just real quality stuff.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so, I wanted to mention that I guess we went past the first anniversary of the Retro Computing Roundtable, so it started in October of last year. Of course, originally it was we had a rotating panel of other co-hosts, and so then, of course, Carrington and Earl joined.
Then there was a coup, and Earl and I took over.
It's a hostile takeover.
Forced their will upon the show. But anyway, it's a happy one-year anniversary. I think we'll celebrate it again when it comes to our anniversary, just the three of us. We'll revisit that. So that's what's going on with me. But during this segment, I wanted to mention an email I received, and I wanted to apologize to this person that I've had the david@classiccomputing.com email address for, geez, at least 5 years or so. As far as I know, I've never lost an email. But for some reason, I got an email from a listener. He was asking about the archives, listening to old episodes of RCR, and so I saved it so that I could email him back and then address it on the show, and then it just disappeared. And the thing is that Classic Computing email is a POP email, so I get it on four places: online, my iPad, my Mac, and then my smartphone. I have to delete them manually, each one, and which is a pain.
Terrible setup.
Did not delete them, so it's just weird. It just disappeared. So yeah, I apologize to you. I don't remember your name, but so I would have responded, but that's what happened. In any case, to answer your question, so if you go to the webpage for if you go to classiccomputing.com, and then you link off to podcasts and then Retro Computing Roundtable. So on the main page, there's a link and it says link to archive, and you can go there. And then there's all the shows where you can go to any individual show and either listen to it online. Of course, you can – well, I know I'm dancing around on what I'm saying here, but the problem with MobileMe, who hosts this, and then iWeb, is that it automatically moves these things to the archive place, and I can't stop it from doing that. And once it does that, the RSS feed – so here's another problem, guys, with our current situation. It drops off of iTunes. I don't know if you guys knew that, but that's something out of my control. So if you go visit iTunes and subscribe, you can only go back, I think it's 5 or 6 shows.
But letting people know we are working on that.
Yeah.
Yeah. We don't have details to release, but
because I'm actively hindering the operation.
Yeah, Carrington's dragging his feet again. But we're working on it, guys, including the website as well. So, hang in there.
So, right, we're working on a domain and a new site and a new hosting platform for all the podcasts and all. But just to finish the thought here, so for instance, if I go, last show was in two parts. So at the top of the page here, if I go to part two of RCR show 17, so as soon as you get there, right near the top, it says podcasts could take a few minutes to load or download any podcast directly here. And if you click on that link, it takes you to a page where you can download any show, just download it directly. So that's helpful.
Any show any person of all time.
Any shows that, this show and any other shows that I've done, since this has been my personal platform for a while. But also, if you scroll down, doesn't it have a link to the archives? Oh, no, it doesn't.
So we'll look back.
Yeah. Maybe I should, I think I'll add that at the top, too, on all the new shows here.
Actually, I think looking back is what we do, isn't it?
Yeah, actually. We only look back, which is why we're such bad drivers.
So I think that sums it up for what I've been up to in some of these show notes here. So let's move right along to the show. So first up, Carrington, is your entry the 1942 Game of Nim?
The Game of Nim, yes. So a fellow in a guy named, what is his name?
Mike Mozart.
Mike Mozart. It's a toy review fellow, and he picked up this electronic game. It's like a little hand-built electronic game. It's the Game of Nim. It's signed on it, Ray Redheffer, 1942, MIT. Now, do you guys know what the Game of Nim is?
I've heard of it, but
yeah,
I'm not
so
sure.
It's basically a mathematical game, and there's a few different ways to play it, but essentially it's one of those games where two or more people, usually two people, take turns taking one or more things off a heap. So you might have three piles, and you can take one, two, or three chips, say, off a pile, and the person who has to take the last piece loses. That's the typical format. So it's one of those things where you take turns, and you try not to go last. But the Game of Nim, I looked on Wikipedia, that kind of stuff. It's generally known to be the first electronic computerized game, but from 1950s, like from 1952, there was a version, like a 50-pound machine version. But this is one that seems to come from 1942, if the signature can be believed. Ray Redheffer was a fairly big American mathematician. His middle name is funny. It's Moose, like a bunch of cows would speak Moose. And so this is apparently an early 1940s electronic version of Nim. So it may be one of the first, quote unquote, computerized video games. So just an interesting thing. There's a very brief YouTube review of the game.
And in the Wikipedia article, so it says in the entry, it was probably the first ever electronic computerized game. It has the year 1952. Herbert Koppel, Eugene Grant, and Howard Baylor, engineers from the W.L. Maxon Corporation, developed a 50-pound machine. One thing about the YouTube entry is this guy, Mike Mozart.
Right.
I've watched tons of videos by this guy. He is hilarious.
Mm-hmm.
So
and he does a toy fail thing and stuff. And
oh, yeah. And yeah. So if you're interested in, like, especially historical toys and just fun reviews and, like you say, even newer ones where there's, like, failures of how they work or their depictions or whatever, I really recommend Mike Mozart videos because it's a lot of fun. One thing about this, the actual game here, is if this, in fact, is an authentic, I mean, that was built in the 1940s. I've got to think that the plexiglass or the plastic there was added later.
Well, I think it was. The case of who knows whether it's really from that. Like, we don't know what the...
Recreated.
Yeah, exactly. So it seems to be signed by this guy, and he definitely did math and did stuff with the Game of Nim, so it's appropriate, and the guy worked in electronic stuff later on, so maybe. Definitely the case at this end must have come later. At the moment, it's all up in the air. But it's
inside. It looks pretty old.
Absolutely, yes, and it's neat. So it's sort of a recent discovery. I don't think a lot of people know the exact history of this particular one yet, but I found it very interesting, and I'm very interested in really early computer games and things. So it just caught my eye, and it's a very brief YouTube video, and people who are interested in the subject should definitely go check it out.
One last thing that's funny about the guy Mike Mozart is being a toy reviewer. I mean, this guy's got this huge warehouse that you see in these videos, and he's done a couple where he's just walking through his gigantic warehouse, and just grabbing stuff. Oh yeah, this da da blah blah. But apparently, he's gotten feedback from people saying that he looks like the guy in Toy Story 2, the kind of heavyset bad guy. what was his name? Big Al, right? I think Big Al's Toy Barn. And so in one of his videos, he's like holding a little Woody guy, and he actually starts imitating Big Al. So I'm like, oh, here's his velvet hat, or, his final hat. And it is so hilarious.
Right.
So I really recommend find that because it's great. It's comedy gold.
So I don't know a ton about this game. I don't know a ton about this particular iteration of it. I don't know what its real history is, but it caught my eye. It's kind of pretty, and I thought it was neat. So that's what I'm
going to do. Yeah, cool. That's very cool. And I added a link just, of course, to the Wikipedia article about Nim.
Cool.
So you can read
up. Did you find an online emulator for the game?
Oh.
No, I'm just kidding.
Let's see if there is one.
Let's see if there's one for the PDP-11.
It brought up another Wikipedia article called The First Video Game. But let's see, here's a second one. It says NIM game. Simulation of the NIM game with 13 matches.
Huh. Oh, sure, and you take them and just try not to take the last match. There's lots of different versions of NIM.
I've heard of it before, just in passing, though. All right, well, moving on to our next topic is, so just briefly, I wanted to bring up Steve Jobs again, who, of course, is still, still been in the limelight quite a bit after his death. I guess he's been dead about a month now. And in any case, his book was released. I pre-ordered mine a few months ago. Now, granted, I know there's God knows how many thousands of copies they're sending out, but I kind of expected to have gotten it sooner than I did, considering I pre-ordered it, because otherwise I could have just walked into a local bookstore and gotten it. So it didn't arrive that promptly, and in any case, I decided to go ahead and buy the audiobook, and I ended up listening to the audiobook before the physical book arrived. And I didn't realize it, but the audiobook, which I think is like nine hours or so, it's an abridged audiobook, so it's not the entire book. It was very good. I have the real book here is like over 600 pages. So I have not read the full book.
I have read it. What did you think of the book?
You read the entire book?
Yes, I have.
I think I liked it, and gosh, it's just I'm trying to come up with a. I'm wondering if since I did not read, if you will, or hear the entire book, did I miss out on quite a bit more negative stuff about him or something? Because my opinion of what I took in from the abridged audiobook is. There's certainly some other negative stuff that comes out about him, but I think overall, I think he balances out as a pretty, decent human being, not just a total jerk up until his final years or anything. But I've heard some other reviewers and discussion on this topic, and what is your take?
You mean whether I think the book sees him with rose-colored glasses?
Well, yeah, I mean, do
I mean,
you think...
I do agree that it's not a particularly negative... I think it's as negative as something that is really coming... This is essentially an autobiography. It might have been written by somebody else, but it's written through interviews. It's overviewed by him. It's the official biography. Those are never going to be scathing. I guess it comes with maybe a bit of a positive bias or spin on it. But I did think that it still wasn't being completely candy-coated.
No,
he doesn't come across as a saint who does no wrong or what have you. You know, he comes across as a very opinionated genius.
Yeah, and I think whether or not, it doesn't hold a little bit of bias because, like you say, it's essentially coming out of his own mouth and then just being written by the biographer or whatever. I still think it's quite admirable of Steve Jobs that he allowed this man to just completely, here, I'll just answer all your questions and tell you whatever you want to know, and then you make a book and I'm not going to stand in your way, or you have full control. And, that's pretty neat. So I recommend it. I enjoyed the book. And again, I listened to it. Versus reading it, but
me too. And I really like a lot of the book at the beginning deals with earlier stuff, I guess, than a lot of people were interested in. I've heard so many people talk about how they really wish it just focused on sort of I guess maybe the last 5 years or something. But it's not about just the last 5 years. John Gruber was saying how he was sort of bored by the beginning stuff. Like, it should have been really focusing on later Steve Jobs things. But I had a completely different take. Like, I like the fact that it's more all encompassing.
Wouldn't really be a biography if it was just about a segment. It'd be like a partial biography.
I thought so too. So I find that a really strange response, but I keep reading that all over the place.
In any case, I enjoyed it, and so also since that time, so I put a link to Amazon where you could buy that book if you want, or also where you could buy the audio book on CD. I bought mine through iTunes. Downloaded it. There was also a really good PBS special. Did either of you guys see that?
I didn't have the chance. I don't have cable, but
okay. Well, there's a link in the show notes where you can watch it.
Yes, and I like the fact that it's on PBS and they've got a link, a video there that you can actually watch online. In fact, I'll probably watch it right after we're done.
And I think it had some interesting, nothing particularly new necessarily, but some kind of newer, interesting takes on some things that I hadn't really seen, and enjoyable. And it wasn't completely, just perfectly positive in some respects. So recommend that. So lastly, and I'm adding this right now because I almost forgot, is I'm adding a link to where it discussed his sister's eulogy at his funeral. And she talks about like his last moments and some different things. And that's especially good. So I really enjoyed reading that. So check that out. And I guess otherwise we're kind of coming to the end of, you know, really and truly now the Steve Jobs era. You know, he's passed and books have been written and specials have been done. And we're not going to hear as much about him now. So I'm getting my first iPhone on Tuesday.
Oh, you've never had an iPhone before?
No.
Join us.
I've been with Sprint for almost, 6 years or so, and with four phones on one network like that, it would have been somewhat cost prohibitive for me just to jump off and, you know, get my own plan. And so if they hadn't have brought Sprint in, you know, if that hadn't happened recently, I was going to leave Sprint and then go to Verizon or AT&T. So anyway, I'm getting a Sprint iPhone, and last time I checked, it was in Nashville from China. My job on Tuesday.
It's on its way.
There are a lot of fun retro apps and retro things you can do on it. So, for a fan of retro things, it really is fun how many old games and stuff are coming to the iPhone. So it's awesome.
We should do a special part about that maybe next show, about retro apps.
Sure, I got tons. I could do some recommendations. So stay tuned next episode for our special feature.
And maybe for Android too.
No. Only because I don't have one, so I don't know what's fun in the retro world of Android.
Well, there are some things, and I'm finding more and more of it. You know, I got an HP touchpad when they had that blowout sale. And
oh, okay.
One of the things that's been happening is the CyanogenMod people who make best described a version of Android for a variety of devices have released an alpha of Android for the HP touchpad. So I've been running that. And, you know, it's got little speed bumps because it's alpha code, but mostly it runs good. And so lots of apps out there and some retro, in fact, a Commodore emulator that I've got on here right now. So I'll talk some more about that at some point too on the show.
Yeah, which that'd be great. You could come from that side of things with the Android and then I guess Carrington, you from the iOS. And because your HP touchpad uses, WebOS.
Natively uses WebOS and can also dual boot into Android using this CyanogenMod software that they released.
Which, you know, this is not retro news, but, you know, HP reversed their decision about not doing hardware, specifically, you know, desktop, laptop computers and all. So it makes you wonder, is that touchpad going to come back?
No, I think they've put a bullet in WebOS,
yeah,
I think
so
I read.
Too.
Dang it.
Whereas the iPhone can now, the newest operating system for the 4S, it can dual boot into a Motorola StarTAC.
I got it.
stay with me, folks.
And it can inflate into the same size. Right?
I think the iPhone's larger.
A special case.
I think we'd have to shrink.
iPhone transform.
That would be cool. You know, I swear, did I see that somewhere? You know what that original big cell phone looked like? Like a brick? Like a big giant one, remember?
Sure.
I thought maybe I saw one of those where you could stick your real cell phone in it. it's like an iPhone case or something. Or I saw something similar. I'll have to look it up. Well, Earl, you take it away then on your on the next topic.
So this is an article about Maker Faire and specifically about how it's becoming cool again to be a geek. And I think the article is good, but I think the broader subject also is interesting, that there's been a lot of activity with people tinkering with electronics or building their own hobby projects, that kind of thing. And it does remind me, I was very young, but it reminds me of the 70s when this computing stuff was taking off and you know, you wouldn't just necessarily go buy a computer, but you'd buy a kit and you'd put it together. And like the original Timex Sinclair was one of those. Wasn't it the 1000? Didn't you actually buy those and then put them together? You didn't get those preassembled, right?
I think the ZX81 is the one the ZX80 in the United Kingdom, but then the Sinclair ZX81 you bought as a kit. And then
that's the one? Okay.
Yeah, then once Timex
Really?
Partnered up with them. They were built.
I had one of those. Yeah, I think maybe I had a later one, because I had a lot of kit computers when I was just a wee lad. But I think my Timex, I don't know why I pronounced it that way, my Timex came assembled. I could be wrong. I was really young. Maybe my dad assembled it for me.
I know they made a kit computer. I couldn't remember which model it is. Shame on me. But that it was actually fairly common to build electronics kits, and mm-hmm. there were lots of books you could do with TTL digital circuits. I did a lot of that.
And that's the weird thing, because so did I. And I had a couple of Heathkit computers, I think, before that. Most of my early computers, I had to assemble either all of them or bits of them. But I thought that the Timex I had, I didn't have to. Like the earliest non-assembled computers, I had like that, the Apple II, I didn't have to assemble, and I had a Tandy Coco, and I didn't have to, and I thought the Sinclair was another one where it just came and, you know, was all ready to go and ready to disappoint me from right out of the box.
Well, you guys have probably noticed this increased activity, increased enthusiasm for electronics hobby stuff.
Yes, and hacker spaces, which we talked about before on the episode.
Yeah.
Exactly. It smells an awful lot like back then, and it's really exciting. And, as part of this, Radio Shack has kind of done a turnaround. It got to where when I'd walk into the local Radio Shack, it's like, hey, you want a cell phone? No, I'm here for an electronics kit. Okay, cool. What kind of cell phone you got? it just totally dropped the ball on hobbyist stuff, and they've done a 180.
A cell phone with that?
Exactly.
Have they really? Because the last time I was in a Radio Shack, it still was the Shack of Disappointment, that they sell batteries and phones and tiny toys.
Coming this fall, you'll notice Arduinos are going to be there.
Well done, a
bunch of stuff from the company Parallax that makes the propeller microcontroller and a variety of kits and robots and stuff like that. There was a video on Parallax's site of the shipments when they were taking the crates out that were off to the various Radio Shacks in the United States, getting ready to get on the shelves there. Yeah, I was very happy.
Now, here in Canada, Radio Shack is not the company it used to be. Like, it's split. Like, the Radio Shack name is owned by a different company. I think Circuit City in Canada ended up owning the actual old Radio Shack stores. I could be wrong about this. Maybe this is some form of slander or libel or something. But as far as I can remember,
I'll sue
right
you.
Right up until the date I'm sued about this, I'm pretty sure that places that are called Radio Shack have no relation to the old Radio Shack here in Canada. Instead, we have The Source by Circuit City, which Circuit City, I guess, still exists in Canada, and those ones are the rebranded stores still associated with Radio Shack in the States. I don't know. Canada is a very strange place. Very strange. And Metro.
I think you're right, though. I think there might have been some sales of branding and that kind of thing for the Canadian chain. I don't think that's the same case for the American Radio Shack chain, although, they tried to do some branding for a while. They tried to just call themselves the Shack, and that did not work. So one more thing I wanted to mention on this article, though, they're specifically saying how it's getting cool for kids to be in on this maker stuff, the teenagers and that kind of thing, which I just think is so cool. And I'm saying, we probably all got hooked young, right?
And then it stays with these kind of things. If you get turned on with it as a kid, it will stay with you.
Yep.
And let me add it at our next meeting, which is next Saturday, in fact, for the AHCS. So one of our members, Alan Lee, is giving a presentation. So he's a maker, if you will, and he's making, cards for, old computers, which there's a rise in that. Let's see, real quick, some other show notes here. I added a link to Make Magazine. Highly recommend it.
Yeah.
So Make Magazine, go to their site. They have a maker store. They have podcasts. They do the maker fairs. Go to the bookstore, look at a copy of Make Magazine. Too great. Radio Shack, it said up until 2005, the Intertan company was using the Radio Shack trademark. And then Radio Shack tried to come back into Canada. They were stopped. And then they closed all 9 of their other stores in 2007. So now The Source by Circuit City was sold to Bell Canada, and it was rebranded as The Source. Anyway, that's from the source of all knowledge.
It's on the internet. It must be true.
Hey, guys, scroll all the way down to the bottom of the show notes.
Can't make me.
Do you see that link to Amazon, which will be in the show notes for our listeners? But click on that.
All right.
Why?
Oh, very nice. Very nice. The other thing that I saw, since
should
we're
we describe to the listeners, we're making pretty bad radio here, what this very nice thing is.
Uh-huh.
Go for it, David.
It's an 80s retro iPhone case, so it takes your iPhone and makes it look like a big brick phone. I wish it was big, actually. It would be cooler, but...
Actually, it would be a great thing for... Too bad we're past Halloween, because this would be a great addition to anybody who wants to go as Crockett or Tubbs. You get your pink shirt, your dress jacket with the sleeves rolled up. And
yeah, but I can't get the raspy voice or the day-old beard. But aside from that, I'm good to go.
You can't get a day-old
beard? Aside from that, I look exactly like Don Johnson. So,
but you can get the
pictures of me are alive.
$15. $6 shipping. Not bad. Excuse me. Not bad. All right.
I do want to mention, since you mentioned that, David, I also want to mention one other thing. You can find a Bluetooth-enabled cradle, the handset that looks like the old AT&T phones.
Right.
And it's the same shape and the same size. So people, I've even seen a picture of this online, bought them. They Bluetooth, joined them with their cell phone. But then you can use them in an old style acoustic coupler modem.
Oh, sweet.
Really?
Because it's the right form factor for that. Now, I don't know if it actually worked, but I saw one cradled in an acoustic coupler. I was like, yeah, that's exactly what I'd like to do.
Oh, here's one called Off the Hook Bluetooth Handset.
Yeah, Bluetooth pairs with your cell phone, and you can be old school, and it might even work with something like 300 baud, because you probably don't need much fidelity to do that.
Which is
I've
funny
seen them where they actually plug in.
And that's good because, like, for someone like me, I gave up having a landline years ago. I think it's 3 or 4 apartments ago is when I last had a landline. I honestly don't remember what year it was. So I haven't had the ability to use a plug-in modem of any sort for ages. So it is the kind of thing that could open that up to people like me who are very cutting edge. Very.
Yep.
Moving along to our next item. This is from one of our listeners. His name is James Payton. And he says, he's developed a new game for the Texas Instruments home computer or emulator. He says, Moon Man is my first program and my first game. It runs on the TI home computer, and it is written in TI Extended Basic. If all goes well, it should be ready for free download on 11/11/11. So,
and shout out to James, by the way. He's also a longtime Retrobits listener. And it's funny because I just saw a TI Extended Basic cartridge last night on the sell-by-trade table there at the Commodore Club. So you really needed that cartridge.
How was that allowed?
It's a Commodore Club meeting. It's not strictly, they don't, check you at the door, pat you down. Do you have anything non-Commodore?
I would have gone, who let this guy in?
I got a mini computer.
Anyway, so check out his video, and it's pretty cool. Try playing it. I have to try it. I haven't done much with it. Bring us back to emulators again. I'd like to do more of some emulators. Emulators and lasers. All right, well, we're going back to Apple and Steve Jobs a bit. So, because recently the iPod celebrated its 10th anniversary. So, Carrington, you talked to this. And I'm going to pull my 10-year-old iPod out of the drawer right here.
Me? Yeah, it was just one of those things where, there's been lots of Steve Jobs talk, which I guess isn't really that retro. But if you think about it, he has introduced us to a lot of products that now are, just ubiquitous. But I guess in a sense are old enough. And that's something I'd like to ask you guys. Like, how old does something have to be retro enough for the show or retro in general? But it's funny. It doesn't feel like the iPod has been around for a decade.
I know, that's amazing.
Yeah, I remember when the first iPod came out, that the 5-gig wonder. I had one of them. I was immediately sold on it. Like, I just thought it was the most amazing thing that you could carry that many songs and something just the size of a deck of cards. It was always the big push. It was the size of a deck of cards. Nowadays, people say, I don't understand what that means, but whatever. And
I'm embarrassed to say that. When they introduced the iPod, I was, I was not that enthusiastic about it.
Oh, I was. I thought it was the most amazing thing because it was a 5-gig hard drive and it was FireWire. I mean, the fact that I could use it that way as well as carrying the music. I just thought this was because I had
MP3 players before. Of course, it was $400, wasn't it?
Yeah, but I've always been a spoiled brat. So, yeah. You know, money means nothing to me. Whatever. So it's just one of those things. I had a number, I don't know, 4 or 5 MP3 players before that. And I had all the problems with those that I imagine Steve Jobs saw in them. I hated the interfaces. I hated the way to get songs on and off them. I hated the look of them. I hated the crappy buttons. I there was so much about them that were annoying, and yet they were so much more awesome than using like a cassette player or whatever, so I still had them. But as soon as I saw an iPod, I just completely fell in love with it. I loved the look of it. I liked the little screen. I loved the 5 gig size and how fast it was to get things on and off because of the FireWire. And so it was just one of those real game-changing devices for me. And while it's only 10 years old, so that's not like super retro, it sort of surprised me that it's been a full 10 years since that came out, because I honestly remember the ads. I remember getting it. I remember so much about it. So I'm old enough now to have things more than a decade old that are still that vivid to me.
And then, you know, about the question of how old does something have to be, I know before the show, the three of us were talking about, and Earl, you brought up about the classic computing discussion list, the CC Talk, and there's also CC Tech. It used to be just one years ago. But, you know, I joined that list fairly early on in 97, and that discussion came up early on. And so sort of the common answer has always been 10 years, the 10-year rule. And I think that's a good, you know, starting place rule. But also I think it just depends on, I mean, think about how much the iPod has changed in 10 years. I mean, so I don't know, even a 7-8-year-old iPod is kind of retro and historic at this point. But, you know, definitely 10 years is a good general rule.
I have two brief comments on this. One is, I think...
Hey, you're wrong!
What is wrong? Second, you're still wrong.
Right, go ahead.
One is that I think it depends on the genre of device you're talking about. Mobile devices age in dog years, seriously. Mm-hmm. So yeah. iPod, 10 years old, definitely retro.
Wednesday is,
you know,
retro.
But if you're talking about desktop computers, you know, you go back 10 years, aren't you talking about Windows XP?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree, especially now. But I guess
really good point, Earl.
If you consider when this rule was first thought of, let's just say 97, well,
right.
87... big changes happened.
10 years before 97? Yeah, that sounds retro.
Yeah. So now I think that rule, you're right. Because if you're to ask me, let's stick with the PCs then, where does retro start? I would throw out the year at this point around 95. Because, you know, once Pentiums came out and Windows 95 came out, PCs were already kind of generic, but they got way more generic, in my opinion. So I consider a Windows 95 Pentium 60 or whatever at the tail end of retroness, even though that's debatable too, you know, in the PC world. And then I don't know what else is there. Yeah, and that's about it. There's only Macs and PCs by that point.
No, I tend to agree with that. I'm just the other comment I had is, if you get 3 retro computing enthusiasts in a room, you're going to get 5 different opinions on how old is retro.
I will have 4 opinions, and you guys will both disagree.
And yeah, so that it's a very difficult thing to nail down. I know sometimes people get even heated about
it. I think
it.
A lot.
Well, that's not retro.
Personal.
Get off my lawn.
Yeah, I think it is such a subjective thing. For me, most of my life, for instance, old has been twice as old as however old I am right now. And that seems to be the case. And for me, retro seems to be, you know, anything before I personally was around 20. So, I think it's just very subjective. Like, for me, retro is 80s and earlier. Anything in the 90s can't be retro. There was grunge. Like, it's not retro. But for my nephew, who's 16, retro might be anything 4 years older. Retro would be a PS2.
Yeah.
So I do think it's very much subjective, and a crotchety old fellow like me, I think retro is like, you know, 20 years ago minimum, and 10 years ago just seems way too recent. Or maybe retro could be anything, any electronics that existed before I kissed a girl. Bingo. And just like everyone should know my personal timeline and adjust their opinions of retro accordingly or whatever. Douglas Adams had a really funny thing he said or wrote or had attributed
to Douglas Adams,
where he said anything that exists before you turn 20 is natural and normal and the way things should be. Anything that exists or anything that's created between when you're 20 and 30 is new and exciting and you can probably get a career in it. Anything that is created after you turn 30 is abhorrent and terrible and against nature.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, I'm butchering his words, no doubt, but I think it's one of those things. I think it's indicative of that these sorts of things are always very much subjective, which isn't to say that I'm right and everyone else is wrong, because that goes to the heart of really my opinion here. But I think for me personally, 10 years is way too soon to be considered retro.
Mm-hmm. And I think in computers, so if I was just, again, throw out some dates, desktop, laptop computers, I'm going to say at least 15 years or older is where it begins to be at retro. With like handhelds, PDAs, way younger, because they don't even exist anymore for the most part. And then smartphones too. I think even if you took a 2005 BlackBerry, that's pretty darn retro.
Maybe it does come down to when there's a paradigm shift. If you think about it, like smartphones before the iPhone are a whole different category, and you could consider maybe anything pre, you know, one big touchscreen is a retro phone. It does come down to a paradigm shift in the particular category.
I think you're right. I've got a handspring visor.
I love when people say
one of the old monochrome guys, I think that's roughly a decade old, but it looks archaic. It looks Stone Age, like I'm chiseling on a stone tablet by comparison to today's. Even my iTouch second gen, it just absolutely blows it out of the park. Mm-hmm. There's not even a comparison that's reasonable. So
in the show notes, Carrington, there's the YouTube Steve Jobs introducing the iPod, which is very interesting. And of course, comments, as always, are interesting. And then there's an iPod interactive timeline. And then there's a YouTube video called the 10 years. Is that a YouTube video? The 10 years of iPod commercials?
I think it's just a list.
Oh, Wired.
Yeah, a Wired little article where they're basically saying here's – and kind of goes through the iPod commercials and how they've changed over the decades. So I just found it sort of interesting how much has changed with the iPod. And the iPod itself as a category seems to be sort of drying up and going away as the whole iPod functionality gets incorporated into other things we carry around. I have had many, many iPods, but now that I'm an iPhone guy, I don't have really a reason to have an iPod anymore. I've got all of that functionality on me, unless I was going to buy something like a Nano or a Shuffle that was a very particular use. In fact, I think I have a Nano and a Shuffle, and they might be just for use at a gym to go to one.
This is so perfect, and it rounds out the conversation just perfectly. So in closing, this topic is, again, I'm about to get my first iPhone in 3 days. And I've had an Android phone for 2 years, and I haven't been unhappy with it, but it has not been my iPod. It just was not a convenient or efficient way for me to have an iPod. I've used a Shuffle most of the time just to listen to my tech podcasts, computer history ones, and other stuff. And I'm a big iPod, you know, podcast listener and iTunes user. Mm-hmm. So I flirted with other Android phones. I seriously at least considered the Galaxy, Samsung Galaxy 2, whatever it's called, you know, the real nice bigger screen. Mm-hmm. There's obviously some pros to some Android phones. You know, the iPhone has not grown its screen since it came out. But anyway, along those lines, in our other conversation about how old is retro, I added one more video. So I watched this just recently because I'm all excited about getting an iPhone. This is Steve Jobs' original introduction of the iPhone. This is only 4 years ago. Very interesting. And just, if you have a chance, watch that. And just, even the original iPhone and the way he introduced it and the whole thing, think about how retro that is.
So to have four years is retro.
Well, one thing that really stood out to me about it too is he makes a big point of comparing other smartphones and how, you know, essentially lousy their operating systems are and their web browsers, and he points out that the core of the iPhone is Mac OS 10. Now they don't say that anymore. You know, of course it's now iOS as well. Right. It's not just iPhone OS, but you know, that's not really, they don't make a deal about, oh, and its core is Mac OS, because it still is. It's a Macintosh phone. But they don't ever do it that way. I don't know. It's kind of, you know, they felt that it was important to stress that earlier on. But anyway, just that, you know, yeah, even the iPhone has kind of evolved and changed quite a bit in 4 years, I think. So, Earl, why don't you go ahead and take it now to the next topic?
All right. And I know we're a little shy on time, so I'll go quick on these. But two internet destinations that I wanted to recommend for retro computing folks. One is the vintage computer forums. We've talked about this on the show, and we've talked about one of the subforums they have, which is the vintage computer marketplace, where you can go look for postings of things you might want to buy or sell. But just in general, the forums there, they've got a lot of subgenres of vintage computing that they talk about, lots of different brands or architectures like S100, CPM, DEC, Commodore, Atari, Apple. And while it may not be the most, what would I say, frequented choice for any of those particular genres, like the Apple II people might congregate in a specific spot, it is probably the best overall forum that I've seen on vintage computing, with just tons of activity there. I subscribe to them via the RSS feed, and I get lots of postings every day on a variety of things, and I just love it. So we'll have a link for that up in the show notes. It's pretty cool. The second thing, the destination I wanted to talk about is C128.com. There's been a lot of postings there recently, some interesting Commodore stuff. The thing that I find really interesting about this particular website, it's owned and maintained by Bill Hurd, who's the father of the Commodore 128. And so while you see a lot of retro computing forums that are put up by enthusiasts on a particular platform, it's more rare to see somebody who actually built the stuff back in the day jump in and get involved and run a website, run a forum, and have participation going there. There's great stuff on that particular site, but I just thought it's also fun that it's Bill doing it. He's heck of a nice guy, and so
I didn't know that. I didn't know about this. And then on the webpage, well, there's a video right here, but in it, so there's a picture of, I guess, Chuck Peddle and darn it, what's her name? She's real big in Commodore.
Jerry Ellsworth.
Yeah, right.
She is awesome. Speaking of people who make things, she is a very cool constructor of very cool things.
Many very cool things. Yeah, just
self-made engineer. Right.
Exactly. So yeah, the C128.com, definitely a place to visit.
Cool. And just going back to vintage computer forums, while you're talking about it, and I was there, like someone posted about selling their Apple II for $5,000. Did you see that? It's a 1979 Apple II with original motherboard ROMs. So it just ended like on the 27th, sold for $5,000.
What the heck?
That's
something weird is going on eBay. I almost feel like there's a shadow collector out there who's got tons of cash and doesn't really care. They just want to win it. I've noticed some pets. We were just talking about this last night at the Commodore meeting. Some of the Commodore pets have been going for outrageous prices, especially the 2001 series. I almost feel like I need to take mine and put in a vault or something like that. Weird stuff.
Yeah, so I almost chose one of those as my my eBay auction, and partly because I can't believe the prices on these things.
And you can't see, in recent years, this has all changed where you can't see who the high bidder was. They block out in between their name. But so this person came in, last person came in, boom, $5,145. They beat the other guy by $100.
But I mean, so somebody else was going to bid just $100 less than that. Like, that's what I don't get.
Yeah, so there were three people involved. So the third highest person went up to $3,300. His next person came in with $3,500, then went up to $5,000, and then ultimately the last person came in at, $5,145.
And there's been too many of these that I don't think it's shilling either. People like falsely bidding in collusion. I think it's really happening, so I can't explain it.
Maybe it's money laundering. You do that, you just grab a thing, you post it on the market. Because it seems bizarre that would go for that much money.
Yeah, but I mean, I guess they're getting pretty rare. But I mean, just off the top of my head, but an original Apple II, not a Plus, and obviously not an Apple I. But I mean, in the past, maybe 1,000, right? What do you say? It tops out.
Maybe.
Yeah, maybe if it 2000? Was in great condition. $1,000. I guess it was in great condition. It's an Apple II, not an Apple I. I mean, yeah, it was a real game changer, and I'm the most pro-Apple guy you'll find, but even I think, what the heck?
Well, you know what? And Steve Jobs died recently. I mean, could that have anything to do with it? Why that went up?
He's bidding from beyond the grave.
Well, he does get credit for the case, you know, he played a big part in its marketing and designing the case and all that kind of stuff. So
it could have something to do with it, but boosting the value by that much.
Unless collectors are coming in that aren't from the vintage world and are thinking, hey, this stuff is like baseball card type thing. Maybe they're just...
You mean like speculation?
Speculators, exactly.
I don't know. Like I honestly can't justify why there would be multiple people willing to spend over $5,000 on an Apple II.
Stupidity apocalypse.
Yeah, or they know something I don't. Like,
yeah, 2012 is coming. Get them while you can.
Spend that money.
All right. So we're going to move along to the auctions.
Speaking of spending money.
We'll review the auctions from last show. And so the first one being Carrington's choice of Ootopos. Is that right?
No one knows how to pronounce it. I've always said Ootopos.
Ootopos.
Ootopos. It sold for about $60, I believe. Yeah, $59.78 with eight bids. So that was the original version from Sentient Software of the extraterrestrial adventure game for the Apple II. Something that does come up not too infrequently. This version doesn't come on eBay very often, but the game comes up. And I always want to have it, and I'm always outbid by the others. This is the least I've seen this version of this game go for, so maybe I should have bid. But even I don't think I would have brought myself to spend over $60 on this thing. Although I really, really, really want this game. But I did not bid.
Interestingly, I have it right here, and I'm going to open it.
Oh, so this is what it feels like to listen to my podcast.
No, I'm kidding.
So,
it's really a bag of potato chips, Carrington. Don't worry.
So I still don't have a copy, but it did sell. I figured that it would. It's a game that always, always sells. But usually for more than this. Usually this version of it goes for well over 100. And I honestly forgot all about it, so I didn't bid. But I don't think I would have bid this much anyway, so I didn't actually lose out here. So it sold.
So next up was my choice, an original Macintosh Mac 128K computer system, 1984, Steve Jobs. I'm just reading the title of the thing. It's kind of interesting. It had a starting bid of $12.99. I buy it now for $14.99. On the 17th, it ended of October, and it ended because it says this listing was ended by the seller because the item is no longer available. In other words, they canceled it, and it hasn't been relisted. So I can only imagine maybe they sold it on the side.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think? Maybe I think $1,200 right now if you cancel the.
Does that violate eBay rules?
No, I think before he had no bids. So I think until you have bids,
so if you have no bids, I think you can pull it. Yeah.
Yes.
And I think that maybe what happened was he started thinking he could get more or sold it
less. Yeah. Let me see. Does he have any other items? Nope. I think there are some rules though as far as how many times you can do that. You can actually cancel them with bids. You can cancel the bids, and then cancel the auction. But I think it's limited how many times you can do it or under what circumstances. I don't know.
Right.
I haven't had to do that in a long time. Oh, that's right. We had Blake, our special guest, on the show. And so his item was a Commodore Amiga A1060 sidecar with plus hard card 20. So it sold for $232.50. That's not crazy at all.
No, I think that's a very fair price. Somebody might have even got a deal on that.
So basically, this is an Amiga 1000 with display, keyboard, mouse. Excuse me. And it had the IBM PC XT expansion with hard drive and 5 1/4 disk drive. So, yeah, that's pretty historical. It's rare with the hard card in it.
I think the computer wasn't part of the auction, right? I think it was just the sidecar.
Oh, you're right. Just the sidecar. Okay.
Yeah, and I still think with the hard card 20 in it and functional like that, I still think they got a deal.
Oh, that's right. The hard card is inside the separate unit and everything. Okay. Yeah, not bad. I mean, you can't say it's ridiculous or anything.
Mm-mm.
So Earl Last is the VIC 1020 expansion chassis for the VIC 20.
Yep, and it sold for just under the range that I thought it was going to. I honestly thought 250 to 300, but a little below that, but didn't surprise me. I've never seen one of these in real life.
Hmm. Yeah, $222, six bids. I noticed it. So that was in Canada.
Woohoo.
Yeah, was the other thing in Canada? Nope. I think it was another one of these was in Canada. I think the Macintosh was. Yeah, okay, British Columbia.
Commodore is really big in Canada, had a huge presence there.
Not
so.
With me.
Sorry, Carrington. But they were there. No revisionism.
So, Carrington, take it away with this show's auction items.
Okay, so I'm picking two this time, mostly because it's two items that I don't know a ton about.
I'll talk to you about
them. I really couldn't decide. My main pick is, I'm going, once again, going a little different. I have selected Sony TCM 5000 EV. That is a portable cassette tape recorder. It's an odd sort of choice. This is one of my favorite portable electronic things. Now, most people know the Sony TC-D5. That's the sort of the more famous one. That's the one that all the big pros are always going to recommend and that sort of thing. The main difference between the TCM-5000 and the TC-D5 series is the TC-D5 series is stereo. So what you're getting with a TCM-5000 EV is a mono recorder. And it records on just regular old-fashioned cassette tapes. And if you're looking for a vintage analog tape recording system, like you want to do a recording on the fly or just take soundscapes or interviews or whatever, and you don't want to go digital, this thing is amazing. One of the nice things about this is while it is just mono, the sound quality is incredible. It has tons of fine controls, multiple inputs. It's got a UV meter. You can set the microphone sensitivity. It has both a mic jack and line in stuff. Records. It's one of those things that you can repair it in the field. There's lots of parts still available for this sort of thing. And usually sells for just a fraction of the price of buying the stereo equivalents. This one has a starting bid price of $40. If you're looking for a TCM or the D5 series, you're typically looking at $250 to $500 for those. So, and they just, wow. Because they're so popular, they get, you know, they come on eBay and you just can't get them. Usually even these sell for more, normally, you know, $60 to $100. So the fact that this is coming in here at $40 and has no bids, if you swoop in, you can get yourself a real bargain. It's working. It's got the leather case wrapped around. These come with or sometimes without them. It's much nicer with the leather case because you can attach a strap to it. Just one of those things. Works off batteries, but you can also use AC. Rock solid, bulletproof, amazing audio recording quality. So
free shipping.
Just on regular cassettes. Yeah. And so it's just one of those things where I keep my eye out for this sort of thing. They don't come up that often cheap. And in my opinion, like this is a really good price for this. It's hard to find these things for under.
And you could pull it into a computer, couldn't you?
Oh, sure. Yeah. You just plug it in and it just plays.
And
it even has like a speed recording so you can record things a little faster or a little slower. Like just sort of everything you could want in an analog video record, analog audio recorder. It's not a huge price difference, but the reality is this is going for about half the price you would generally spend. So you'd save yourself $40 if you picked up this one with free shipping. So in my opinion, a real buy for a neat sort of audio recorder. Very niche market. Not a lot of people are going to be looking for this, but I think it's a good buy. My second choice is one that's just more something a little more fun. It's an ISKRA-123. I don't know if that's supposed to be pronounced Iskra or whatever, but it's a Soviet calculator computer that uses 16 Nixie tubes. I have no idea what the heck this thing is other than it looks awesome and I want it so badly. So if you're in the market for a calculator, I think you could do worse than a 1979 Nixie tubed based Soviet. The thing, it says it weighs what is it? Something like 16 kilograms or something? Some massive, heavy thing, and I think it's just delightful. So it looks like more of an adding machine than a calculator, but 16 Nixie tubes. Totally cool.
I love Nixie tubes. You know, we had a programmable calculator that actually read cards that you would mark on with a number 2 pencil, like a little card reader, and you could program the thing, and it had Nixie tubes. It was so fun to play with. There's a look that the Nixie tubes have that you just don't get with anything
else.
Exactly.
And you look at the inside of this thing with all these boards. It's got tons. I think it's a board for each of the Nixie tubes. So just like a massive piece of computer engineering from the 70s. So completely awesome looking.
That's insane.
I want
all
it really,
cards
really badly.
Stuff?
Yeah. So
it's
now,
in the Ukraine.
It's got a starting price of, what is it, $400 or something?
$379.05. It's on sale.
There you go. So buy it now price of basically $380. And honestly, I almost just pulled the trigger on this one instead of recommending it because I just think it's the coolest thing. So there you go.
That is very cool. Yeah. It's massive.
It's massive, heavy, and just awesome looking. So those are my choices.
Soviet technologies is kind of, interesting.
And I've never even heard of this thing. I don't know anything about it. I don't know whether it's rare. I just know that it's so awesome and cool looking that I want to have it. 12.5 kilograms, that's it. So it's about 16 inches wide, 41 centimeters, and 12 kilograms. That's a lot of weight for a calculator.
Wow.
And it's all working. So anyway, those are my choices.
Did you say you knew what that is in pounds? Which is 12 kilograms? Is that what you said?
Yeah, it's 12.5 kilograms. I don't know what that would be in pounds.
I'm trying to, let me convert it real quick. 12.5?
Yeah, it's funny. 20. I can sort of think in terms of inches a bit, but I think in terms of kilograms. I really don't know how much things are in pounds.
It's it looks like a pound is a little more than double. So it's 12.5 kilograms is 27.5 pounds.
Yeah. So it's a 27-pound calculator with 16 Nexity and a ton of computer boards and made by the Soviets in the 1970s. I love it.
Well, thanks, comrade. And I like that that cassette recorder is pretty neat looking.
Yeah, it's just one of those things where people that want to do, sort of lo-fi or not lo-fi, but analog audio recording, for making your own 16mm films or doing soundscapes or audio recording, it really is a rock solid, great thing that you can repair and should work for years and years and years.
So or some kind of special effect, like you wanted to have a more vintage audio sound, even if you're bringing it into digital or whatever.
Yeah, or you just want to, I know a lot of people that use these to record for film because it tracks really, really well, and then you can then import it into a system and then use that to record your audio. And just, it's just a cool way to do audio stuff.
Well, Earl, take it away with your item.
This has to be one of the most interesting eBay auctions I've seen in a long time. It's for an IMSI 8080, the classic one from War Games, along with a couple of terminals and a dual 8-inch disk drive unit. And the person put it up basically with no reserve, started the bidding at a buck or two, I think, or maybe $5. There's already three bids on it, and it's up to a whopping $6. But this still has 9 days, 19 hours. I think the lister is going to be really surprised how much this goes for. They make comments in the item description like, if you don't buy it, it's going to get hauled off to the dumpster. I'm thinking, wow, you seriously don't know what you've got here. It doesn't matter if it works or doesn't work. With that combined with the drive unit and those terminals, this is going to go for an insane amount of money. I mean, if you look at the picture here, they only took they actually only took one picture of the unit, which it's crazy with something this valuable. But all of the flip switches are intact, and it doesn't look like visibly, at least here, there are any major dings or scratches on the front panel.
It's certainly way nicer looking than anyone I have ever seen recently. Like, it's crazy that this thing's there.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. So what do you want to bet they don't know that they're sitting on a gold mine and that when this thing finally closes, there's going to be a lot of head scratching and happy dancing?
I think they got to be joking with the dumpster stuff, though, because like they're saying at the bottom, what a deal. You can start your own computer museum. I mean, they know. And then they included an ad.
The price that they started this at was insanely low. I'm sure they don't know what they've got. Now, the shipping's also weird. It says $5 expedited shipping to me.
No, because he says you have to pick it up. I was reading the description, and he won't ship. And he says, I think he's not very good at eBay. And he says, eBay doesn't seem to let me put a zero in for shipping. You have to come pick this up. There's no shipping. You come to his garage and you get it.
Okay. And once again,
I would drive there and get this.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think I would too, or I'd, get some of my friends in Chicago.
It's in Galesburg, Illinois. Yeah, so.
So there you go.
Well, doing another search for IMSI, it looks like there's only one other one at a buy it now $29.99. So if they did any kind of search, they would have saw that. And then completed listings, let's see here. One sold for $1,600. Oh, here's a VDP-80. Didn't we cover one like that one time?
We did.
It didn't sell, though. So one sold recently for
$1,600. I would so be pretending I was in War Games, so if I had this thing. Or Earl, you buy this, and I'm going to build myself a Whopper.
Would you like to play a game?
I would.
All right. So the last item is mine, and this one is an Amstrad PPC 512 Vintage Retro, the first portable laptop. Yeah, the first portable laptop. In any case, it's not the first portable laptop. It's not.
I actually think that I have the first portable laptop, which is the Epson HX20.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I believe that's regarded by a lot of people as the first. Yeah.
Well, there is actually, I guess, because you're not including luggables. Yeah, I guess they're not laptops, right?
Well, the first luggable, I think, wouldn't you guys say the Osborne?
Yes.
There was a couple before. There was one that was an S100 based.
Oh, you know, wasn't the 5100 even portable? IBM 5100?
Yeah.
Well, technically, anyway, everything's portable if you're strong enough.
I included this one because I just kind of, you know, to be honest, we were running a little late with the show and I hadn't picked one yet. And so I kind of stumbled on it, but I've always thought it was an interesting computer. It's not particularly significant. It's kind of neat that if you look at the picture, the LCD screen, it folds up. So in other words, it folds down and the keyboard folds up and closes on top of the case. So you've got and it's got a picture of it. Here we go. So you've got a nice little package that you can carry around. It's basically, an XT compatible. I've looked at them a few times over, recently, and their value's gone up. Used to be you could get them for nothing, I guess, like a lot of things, but maybe $50. Now they're going for maybe $100. What's interesting here is it's a buy it now for $100. That's not crazy, right? But then look at the shipping.
Yeah.
$145 because it's in Greece.
Oh, okay.
And they need your money.
Yes, support our country. I just give you it.
No, we'll just joke in there. But I looked at the shipping. I was like, oh my God, because it's kind of ridiculous. But it's an interesting machine.
And it's a Amstrad, cool form factor.
Yeah, the form factor is very unique. And Amstrad didn't have a very big presence in the United States. I don't know. Do you know if it did more so in Canada, Carrington?
Not huge.
And the only other one I found was a buy it now at $200. So that's kind of.
So this says it can work off 10 C cell batteries.
Yeah.
But that'd be awesome. But does it take AC power as well? I'm just wondering, I don't know what power system Greece is on. If you purchase this, will it just work in the States or you got to get an adapter?
Oh, yeah. Does it?
I've got that situation. A fella in the UK, a Retrobus listener, sent me a couple of Spectrum 128s. And they're really cool computers, but I can't power them up yet because I haven't figured out how to run them off 110.
Huh. Yeah, I don't know if that can work. Huh?
Yeah, I'm presuming that this was probably built in the UK, but I don't know what power system it would be using. So, yeah.
I know in the Army, back in the early 90s, when I lived in Germany for 2 years, we bought a few transformers. So I guess the correct term, they were step-down transformers. Does that sound right? And then there was a certain ampage.
Hold on. I used to watch Transformers a lot. I don't remember one called Step Down.
So I know that you couldn't use an iron or a blow dryer or something that was very high amps or whatever. I ran my computer and everything off of it. So I don't know if you can step up. I guess maybe you could.
In Canada, most things up here still just run on battery. We can't wait to get AC. Oh, I hear they have it in Quebec. I'm so jealous.
And plumbing. Inside
plumbing. That'd be amazing. I've been holding it since February.
All right, guys, how have we done? I have no idea how long this
I don't know about you guys, but I have done great.
It's over an hour. I know that. Oh, I'm tired. I'm exhausted.
Why do people keep saying that to me?
And kudos to you, David, for doing the show when you're sick here. I just got to say. You're a trooper.
I appreciate it. I feel better.
The like healing power of the retro computing podcast.
Of the RCR.
Yes.
Well, any final shots, Carrington?
Did I mention that I am writing a novel this month?
No.
I am participating in NaNoWriMo, the National Novel Writing Month. So
I've always wanted to do that.
So far failing miserably. I'm way behind on my writing schedule already. So
is it November?
I'm gonna fail. It's November, yeah. So I started on the 1st. So I'm a few days in, and I'm attempting to knock out a novel this month. My first attempt. I mean, I've written a lot of things, including long-form stuff, but I've never tried to write something this long in a one-month period.
It's a novella, right? What's the words on that?
Well, I personally am shooting for – I was hoping to get 50,000 words written. Now I'm hoping to get, you know, 5,000. Like it's going way slower than I had hoped. But I'm the sort of guy who spends a lot of time plotting things, and then the writing comes swifter later. So I'm doing a lot of I really gave it almost no thought ahead of time, just decided to dive in last minute. But it's been exciting. I've been trying to write on it every day and working. It's a comedy horror novel, but a group of vampires, the one guy who gets turned, they're up at a cottage weekend. They've rented out sort of a camp, and they do this, you know, kill him and raise the dead ceremony to bring this guy back to life. But they don't realize that there was a serial killer burying all his bodies around in that place. So they bring up like hundreds of zombies at the same time. So it's basically a zombies versus vampires comedy horror. And it's fun so far, but holy cow, it's hard to write this much this quickly. So we'll see. So far, I'm predicting failure. But
is this
fun.
The right the website nanowrimo.org? Is that the right one?
Yes, yeah.
It says so, November 1st to 30th, 30 days and nights of literary abandon.
That's it, yes.
National and Novel Writing Month.
Exactly. So it happens every November. I've wanted to do it for the last few years. And what's fun about it is a lot of people do it in the city, so they have writing meetups. There's a bunch in Toronto all the time. There's a couple of writing meetups where we're all going to meet on a subway, and everyone sits in the subway car writing, and there's late-night cafe meetups and places, and so you can sort of get together with other people and talk about what you're doing and make it more of a community writing thing, and it's been really, really fun so far. The only problem is I'm, you know, 40% behind on my word count already, and it's not looking good, but we'll see. First try. Oh yeah, no, I'm going to stick with it and see how we do. And what's nice about it is you post stuff publicly, so it helps motivate you to keep on it because you have to keep posting what your word count is, and so you're publicly admitting your failure as you go. So I find that surprisingly motivating. So I got
well,
that.
Earl, yeah. Sounds good. Yeah, and let us know when it's done so we can read it.
Well, it's November 30th.
So Earl, how about you? I guess you're working on your PDP.
Yeah, I'm going to do that. I'm going to watch that PBS special that you put the link for and just kind of chill out. Oh, tonight I'm going to see my favorite rock and roll band, Shonen Knife. They're a three-member girl trio from Osaka, Japan.
I saw them.
They're
once.
Awesome.
Ooh.
Did you really?
Yeah, they're great in concert.
Yeah, they are.
Shonen Knife?
Yeah, they've been around forever. Holy cow. I saw them years ago.
Yeah.
Two words? Yes.
They're on their 30th anniversary tour at the moment, and they actually got started. They were inspired by the Ramones, and so for the 30th anniversary, they decided to do a tribute album, a cover album of the Ramones.
And you can really see they are Ramones-ish, you know? You can totally see.
I wasn't a Ramones fan,
Rock and Roll High School.
Listening to the Ramones now and listening to Shonen Knife, I'm like, you can totally see where the inspiration came from. But yeah, they're always great, and they hang around after the concert and sign stuff and chat with you. And so it's always they usually come to Portland when they're on a U.S. tour. So I'm very excited.
Well,
I saw them in Philadelphia, gotta be 10 years ago, 12 years ago, something, ages ago.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right. Well, closing things out, I was talking about writing, Carrington, it's been almost an embarrassment and anxiety for me, my book, but I had some issues with it, and then so it didn't get printed. I got it back and I fixed the digital issues with it, not the issue, anyway. So, but then I started revising my story that's at the beginning of it, and then I got all caught up in that. So finally I've gotten that done, and I had a good proofreader who's the last part of it's being proofread now. So on Monday, this is finally getting transmitted back to the printer. So anyone that bought one of the books, really and truly, it's going to start being printed now as of Monday. So that's the biggest news
cool.
in my life.
Nice.
Woohoo!
It's great news. It's just such a relief. And it's just, I just wish I had never had such a ambitious schedule, I guess, when I was doing the Kickstarter. I guess a lot of people, they don't normally do that, and everybody's kind of more understanding. Actually, everyone's been very understanding. It was more me saying, it's going to be done by this date, and then, just kept getting pushed back. So that's the big news for me. So that's finally done, and then now I got to get back on my other, podcast, the Stan Veit audiobook podcast, which the next chapter is the one about Apple, which, with current events, Steve Jobs and all, I know there'll be a big demand for that one.
Mm-hmm.
The great chapter.
Mm-hmm.
And that's about it. So,
awesome.
So thanks everyone again for listening and also for supporting the show. And we hope that you'll tell other people about the show and just help us spread the word. We need your help with that. When we finally do move to a new server platform, we'll be able to start tracking how many downloads we have and how big our listenership is. Actually, let me ask all our fans, please, would you drop us a line? Just take a moment, just, hi, I listen, anything. Just write us a quick email. Just, it'd be great if all of a sudden we got a bunch of emails from people and got just a little bit of a feeling of how many people are listening.
Sure, if you just wanted to write in to make fun of David, we're all okay with that.
all five of you, please write in.
And make fun of David.
So email the show at feedback@rcrpodcast.com. And if anyone who's listening, just stop for a minute, anything. Hi, even a blank email, if you were to email that to us, it'll give us some sense of, an audience. Because we don't hear enough from people out there. So, anyway. Now
it'll help redeem our irredeemable self-esteem. Yeah, it's easy for me to say, right?
But we'd love to hear from you, and thanks so much for patronizing us. Is that the right word? For being our listeners. And
don't patronize me.
You can help us out if you did a review on iTunes. And lastly, I guess we're not really using the Twitter feed just yet, the @rcrpodcast.com. This is something that we met about. This is something that we're also working on. So very soon, we'll be announcing a new website with our own domain, and we'll be moving our archives and show notes, and then we're going to be utilizing Twitter. So for now, you can still follow me, Classic Computing, or Classic Computin on Twitter, and or Earl. Which Earl, what's yours again?
It's Retro Earl.
Okay, which is on the show notes too. And Carrington, you're not really doing anything on Twitter right now.
Yeah, I'm at Carrington.
Okay. So any of us or all of us, and we're working towards having a unified, web page and Twitter and all that. So again, until next time,
Retro Compute.
Do you want to do it again, all of us?
Come on, guys.
Okay, 1, 2, 3... Retro computer.
Cut.
So I'll say go, and then we all say. So just like this. Don't do it yet. Go. Retro computer. Stop that. Ready? Go. Retro computer. Please, would you drop us a line?